What do you tell those group of people that are kind of struggling and continuing to get into the same relationships and it's not working for the same reasons, but don't really establish those core values?
I'm of two minds about it. It's more like the serial daters or the people who are in
Correct.
serial relationships, right? So
Correct,
I'm of
correct.
two minds about that. One is, if you aren't doing introspection work inside or outside of the relationship, it doesn't matter if you are with yourself or a single for 12 years. If you never do introspective work and understand who you are on a core level, 12, you ended one relationship 12 years ago, 12 years later, you're going to enter the same exact type of relationship because you haven't done any work.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to another great episode of the Less Rock Podcast. I am your host, Philosophical.
I'm your co-host, Jay Echo. What's good?
What's going on, everybody? As you can see, we got a very, very special guest with Dr. Ebony. She's a licensed psychologist. You know, she is also the creator of the therapy cards, food relationship strategist, speaker, consultant, trauma expert. Her main initiative is helping women heal from trauma and also diet culture. Welcome, welcome, Dr. Ebony.
Thank
Welcome
y'all
to
for
you.
having me. Thank
Yeah,
y'all for having me.
definitely.
Thank you
Definitely.
for coming on.
Thank you for taking the time out with us. Her Instagram and main social handles are Dr. Ebony Online. Really appreciate you taking the time with us and really being able to speak with us today.
Absolutely.
So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, so I wear many hats, like you said. So as a psychologist, most people are just used to us either doing research or therapy, but I have a unique privilege of making myself wear many different hats. And so one thing that I do is therapy. I'm based in Austin, Texas, but I can provide therapy throughout the state of Texas. And fortunately, I can provide therapy in other 30 other states because of a unique licensing agreement that we have with them. So you can check my website for that. But my area of expertise is trauma recovery, and that's basically helping people who have experienced trauma either at the hands of somebody else or race-based trauma or trauma in the workplace. Helping us find our voice again, helping us feel empowered, how to show up in our lives and make meaning that is different from the trauma narrative or victim narrative. As a food relationship strategist, I actually help us build a healthy relationship with food rather than the one that diet culture tells us we should have. The way that I got into doing that is because I started out as a weight loss coach, and the more work I did in that area, I realized was really anti-Black and oppressive. And based on you being skinny, and if you're just skinny and eat the right foods, which is more colonized perspective of food, then you'd be good enough. And I could that didn't sit well with me as a Black woman to tell other Black women that if you would just do this, then you would be good enough. And if you just look like this, you would be good enough. And it's super oppressive, and I didn't want to do that. So I decided that I wanted to do more in the relationship realm rather than the rule-based realm. And so I wanted to understand how people showed up with food and why we do, and help us rewire that and understand that honestly, a lot of the things that we've been taught has been from a very colonized perspective, and how to break through that to have a relationship with food that is true to us and authentic to who we are without losing ourselves. So that's a lot of what I do, and it's a lot of strategizing and figuring out how that shows up in your own unique life. I'm also the creator of my therapy cards, which I created out of a need to address the stigma that exists within our community, for one, but also to address cost. Therapy is super expensive. And to ask somebody to come in and pay me $185 a session is a lot for a lot of people. So I wanted people to have a way to talk to me without talking to me. So I took the questions that I ask clients in my sessions personally, and I put them in the deck, and so that you can access them wherever you live in the world. And so you don't have the barrier of the licensing law stopping you from actually seeing me. So that's the third part, geographic location. You can purchase the deck. It's like $1 a week for 52 cards. So the deck is $49. And it's like working through one card a week, which is $1 a week versus the $185 I'm asking you to pay. And you can get them wherever you live. So out of that first deck that we created, we branched out and created a men's deck and then a teen deck. and then journals to accompany those. But really, it's to help provide representation in a field that has mainly ostracized us, criminalized us, stuck diagnoses on us when overpathologized us and diagnoses on us when those things actually don't fit. And I wanted them, I wanted people to see themselves more in this field, because if we can see ourselves more, then we can feel more comfortable doing the work. And then so because of all the things that I've done, I also now help other therapists build their businesses and platforms in a way where they don't have to sit in one-on-one sessions all of their lives to make their money.
Good point. And that kind of goes into, you know, one of our questions we'll kind of ask going a little later here. So you mentioned trauma. I want to go right into the first question. You know, a lot of your content on your page is centered, you know, and catered toward a lot of working through trauma. Right. So, you know, the first question is what are some traumas you think aren't being addressed before getting in a relationship?
Mm-hmm. So I took some time to actually think about this one, and the ones that came up, a lot of the parent-child relationships, when we're doing work in therapy, especially the way that I practice, when you come into therapy and you're talking about relationship issues or any issues that you're now having as an adult, I'm going to always ask you, what's your earliest memory of that experience? What's your earliest memory of feeling that particular emotion? And many of us are going to float back to our childhood. And many of us are going to float back to our families of origin, our caretakers. So a lot of the relationship issues that we have are because of the parent-child dynamic, be that mother-daughter, mother-son, son-daughter, I mean, son-dad, daughter-dad. Those relationships are foundational. They're pivotal. They are the models by which we come to understand how to interact with another person. So a lot of those issues are not resolved. The issue that I think a lot of people pay attention to is you have daddy issues, when a lot of us are struggling with mother issues. So I don't think that is addressed enough. Also, I don't think that people's past sexual traumas are resolved and healed enough. And also these last two people may not like, but a lot of religious trauma is not handled before people get into relationships. And so there are a lot of things that people are carrying sort of with them. And then just trauma that we experience as being people of color, Black people in this world. I think that impacts all of us. And I don't know a person who has not been traumatized being a Black person in this world. So a lot of those things that we may not have identified being impacted as a form of racism or just, you know, occupying a Black body, I think goes unnoticed and unresolved when we enter into relationships.
Okay. So you brought up a good point that we've kind of spoken about before, as far as like the environment you were brought up in. And I kind of just want to dive deeper into that, kind of the dynamic with a woman versus a man, a man's relationship, essentially with their mom, their mother, and essentially with their father. Mm-hmm. Right. And then the trauma with a woman relationship with their mother versus their father. You know, we know that dynamic has somewhat played a lot of roles when people enter in relationships, right? I know for myself, you know, entering in a relationship, my wife's parents being together, being still married, you know, spoke a lot of the type of environment I knew I was entering myself in, right? That her parents' marriage, being together, was important for me. It builds a foundation of, okay, this is the end goal. She understands the principle of being married, long-lasting marriage, long-term marriage, and essentially her relationship with her mother and her father, right? And I feel like we as men, and even on the flip side, women, that's not really looked at or investigated. Do you kind of agree with that?
Is what's not looked at or investigated the type of environments people grew up in?
As far as men and women really asking, you know, like, how is your relationship with your mother and father? Or even seeing that, you know, in person, like, you know, that could be correlated as trauma, right? If they're not married, right, what's the relationship with his or her parents? Right? Is it good? Is it not good? If it isn't good, what's the reason for that? And is there a potential of him or her treating me because of them not having a great relationship with their mother and father?
Yeah, I just want to clarify. I don't know if this, and I don't know if you said this, I just want to clarify. I don't think it's automatically traumatizing to not grow up in a family where the parents are not married. I don't know if you said that, but I just want to clarify that that's not trauma, because there's a lot of people who grow up in families where there's a single parent and they experience things that happen bad, trauma by being in the body, that kind of thing. But it's not necessarily a trauma just because your parents weren't married. That almost signifies that something is wrong with not being something's wrong with being born into a family where there's not two people. Am I hearing that correctly?
When I say trauma, like for me, I'll even give my experience, right? When I was at a young age, my mom and father separated for reasons that, as I was growing up, you know, I was protected from knowing why, right? And as I grew up, I became confused. I became unsure of how to navigate, you know, through relationships, through friendships, because I was so confused on what is a relationship, what is dating, what is a marriage supposed to be like. And I maybe trauma is the wrong word, but maybe confusion, right? As far as like, confusion as far as like, when I entered in relationships, it's like, all right, because I didn't have that relationship with my dad, and you know what I mean, my mom had passed away, you know, I was looking for that type of security and that type of reassurance from my partner at that time, if that makes sense, right? So almost my question is that, as a man or a woman, is it not necessarily trauma, but confusing to go into a relationship looking for something that we didn't get from our growing up in that environment?
Absolutely. I think that if we're entering relationships wanting anybody to heal our past, or wanting this experience to be the corrective experience that we have that's going to cease all the confusion that we have, that's a lot to put on another person. I think that we don't do enough when we're dating and vetting people to ask, how were you raised? What messages? So the questions we aren't asking is, what messages did you receive about how to show up in a relationship? Which is, honestly, I was going to say it at the end, but I actually have a couple's deck coming out of the therapy cards that ask the questions like, what messages did you learn about being in a relationship? What models did you see about what a healthy relationship was? We're not asking these questions. One, because I don't think we're taught to ask these questions. We're taught to ask questions like, what do you do? How much money do you make? Do you want to have children? Rather than, what did you see in your home growing up about how you should treat people? Or what did you hear? Or what are the messages that you still internalize about relationships and your values around relationships? We're definitely not asking enough questions around values. We are asking questions like, do you believe in God? Are you a Christian? Do you want to go to church? Like those things, but really, what are your core values and where did those come from? Are you still hanging on to some stuff from your childhood that is going to impact or come out later in this relationship? So I do think that it could be hugely problematic if you're entering into a relationship expecting somebody to then teach you how to be in a relationship or be that healing experience that you don't have or didn't have.
Let me, I guess a follow-up question to that is, why don't you think we're asking these questions? Why are people?
I don't think we have the language. To be fair, the only reason I have this language is because of what I do in the world. I'm a therapist, and so I'm exposed to these questions. I think on a level that tries to get to the root of people's problems, right?
Okay.
Everyday people just aren't walking around asking, what messages have you internalized about what it means to be in a relationship? Like, if we're not fed the language, and a lot of the language that we're using, we're being fed through media, through social media. So maybe by the more we're talking about this, the more conversations we're having, people will acquire the language, but just naturally people aren't asking those questions and people don't know how to get to that. So people are asking their own versions of the questions, thinking that they're getting the answers that they have. Like, you know, what kind of dad do you want to be? What kind of mom do you want to be? What kind of husband do you see yourself being? Like, do you, you know, you want to be married forever? So we're asking these questions because these are the questions that we've been taught and conditioned to answer. But many of us just simply don't have the language.
Okay. You had a question, Jay? Go ahead.
So I like that you're I like that you brought up the language that we're using, but then my question becomes, how should we be learning this language? Like, where would somebody just go out and find, like, this? Yes, we're having the conversation right now, but, you know, this isn't a common conversation that people are having, unfortunately. So what are some sources that somebody could just go out and be like, all right, here are the actual questions you should be asking when you're starting a relationship? Not like these sound good, but they're not the actual question you should be asking. Like, how do you communicate that to a customer or your average Joe or whoever?
So it's resources, right? And I think that we live in an age now where we're super privileged and blessed to be able to have technology. So people can get their language from podcasts. Unfortunately, people pick up some of the most horrible language from podcasts and thought, but you can get them from podcasts. You can get them from social media. You get them from listening to conversations that people are having at round tables, panels, which means that you got to get yourself out of your own environment, right? Therapy is a huge resource where you can start to change your language around the way that you think about things, talk about things. You ever talk to somebody, you're in therapy, aren't you? Because you start hearing the language being used that they may not have had before. Language is everything. Language is the way that we understand the world, right? So if you are putting yourself around people who are talking this language through the podcast, through the books, through the magazines, through the therapy sessions, then you're going to acquire a different way of talking about things and understanding things that's going to help elevate you and grow, hopefully, help you grow in an area that could improve your relationship or how you think about things. But I want to say, honestly, the questions that you need to ask are going to be directly tied to your values. So before you get into what questions should I ask, you have to understand what your values are, what that person's values are, because then that's going to determine what's important to you and why y'all are even having the conversation in the first place.
That's actually a good question, Jay. I'm glad you asked that. I have a follow-up question. What do you say? You may have answered this, and I apologize if I've repeated the question, but what do you say to people that are jumping into multiple relationships? Mm-hmm. Acquiring or realizing those core values? Because in my opinion, if you're jumping into multiple relationships, you're not learning, you know, those core values. So what do you say to those people that are jumping into multiple relationships, aren't learning the core values, and then aren't really asking those questions? Do you feel like then it's like, if you're jumping into multiple relationships, you do kind of have some sort of language, because I'm pretty sure those relationships aren't working for a specific reason. So what do you tell those group of people that are kind of struggling and continuing to get into the same relationships, and it's not working for the same reasons, but don't really establish those core values? I don't know if you kind of answered that, or I would love to know your opinion on that.
I'm of two minds about it. So what I hear you asking is more like the serial daters or the people who are in serial relationships, right?
Correct.
So I'm of two minds about that. One is, if you aren't doing introspection work inside or outside of the relationship, it doesn't matter if you are with yourself or a single for 12 years. If you never do introspective work and understand who you are on a core level, you ended one relationship 12 years ago, 12 years later, you're going to enter the same exact type of relationship because you haven't done any work. So in order to change the pattern of who you are and how you show up in relationships, it doesn't matter if you're in a relationship, a different relationship every 6 months, you've got to stop and do some work around who am I? What is showing up for me? How am I engaging? What are my values? What are the things that I find important? If you're a person who's just saying, I'm going to go from person to person because I don't like to be alone and I need to feel safe, then there needs to be some work around safety and trusting yourself. And if you're not doing that, then you're just going to carry that into every relationship, right? So to people who are serial daters without doing any internal work, yeah, you're going to keep repeating the cycle. But if you are a person who's doing relationship work or doing work, it doesn't matter if you're in relationship after relationship, you're going to continue to grow. And those relationships will look different. And I say that because relationships are the place where we learn the most about ourselves. It's a mirror. It's a period of reflection. And it's the dynamic that comes out that shows you typically who you are at your core, right? And so that's deep friendships, that's deep romantic relationships. So if you are a person who's like, well, wait, why did that end? But you end up with somebody in a month, that doesn't make you a bad person because you ended up with somebody in a month. I don't subscribe to the idea that people don't need to be in relationships to do work. I think you can absolutely do work in relationships because that's where you're going to see yourself the most, in relationships. So if you're doing introspection work, understanding what you are accountable for, what your role is, then you can be in relationship after relationship and still growing. The relationship toxicity level may not be severe each time you enter into another relationship. Does that make sense? So maybe if you use like a color grid, maybe this relationship is red zone, but the more you progress, you're inching towards a yellow zone and you're learning more about yourself. So by the time you reach your green zone, now you're in a healthy relationship that may be more lasting and sustainable than those prior, but you're continuing to do the work to elevate.
That's a good point. I've always said that I used to always feel like personally for me is that, you know, I didn't do that work while I was in those relationships because I always felt that work needed to be done outside of a relationship.
Outside of the relationship.
Yeah, and I always felt, and I wonder if a lot of our audience feels that way, like once you're in a relationship, it's almost like, I'm here. I don't have to.
That's when the work starts. That's when the heat turns up.
Exactly. And to be honest, you know, through my personal experience, and I have these conversations with my wife a lot, is that, you know, I constantly have to continue to work on myself, right? Just as much as she's mentioning, you know, she has to earn it. You know what I mean? Because and that's where it comes in. It's not rainbows and sunshines all the time. You got to really put in the personal work. And to be honest, it took me a little while to understand that, because I walked into relationships feeling like I don't need to do that work. You know what I mean? Because I felt like I did the work outside of the relationship. So, yeah. But go ahead, Jay. We'll go into the next question.
I know.
Oh, go ahead.
Brief aside, you may need to resend me those because they're not popping up for me.
Okay.
But what's it called? My question. I know for me personally, like, that's me feeling like the work I need to do has to happen outside of relationships is part of why I've stayed out of relationships sometimes. Like, there have been opportunities there, but it's always been like, oh, I'm not ready yet. Mm. Oh, I have too much work to do. So let me get my game up first, and then I'll enter the relationship. Which, true, there's still improvement that needs to happen. But at the same time, it's like, all right, you can keep doing that work even when you're in a relationship. The problem that I typically would run into is I would enter the relationship and I would immediately start focusing on the other person and ignoring the things that I needed or the things that I needed to do. And I think that's a problem that not only me, but other people have to deal with. And, you know, I know we're not on your couch right now, but what are some suggestions you would give to people like that, who is like, hey, just because you're not, you know, just regarding the situation I just described, what are some small pieces of advice you would give?
Mm-hmm. Keep your rituals for yourself. A lot of times when people get in relationships, they throw all of that to the wind. Like, I don't need to continue to take myself on solo dates, or I don't need to continue to date myself and go out to eat by myself. Yes, you do. You need to still go. There are some times when you would say, you know what, boo, I'm going to take this solo trip by myself just for the weekend because I need to reconnect back to me, because if I lose myself, I can't show up with you. So I'm going to take this time to go eat by myself. I'm still going to date myself. I still got to have date night with myself. We do it with our girls in relationships. We keep our homeboys on our schedule when we get in relationships, but we forget ourselves. And that's the fastest way for you to lose who you are in a relationship. Keep your rituals. If your Sunday mornings belong to you and it doesn't work out for the couple, create a ritual that happens on another day. Maybe Friday mornings cannot be yours, but that's when you do your routine, your face routine. You write in your journal, you do your meditation, you water your plants, you take yourself on a walk, but you still got to make sure that you have time to get centered with yourself, because that's how you're going to keep your values at the forefront. So keep your rituals is number one. Number two, stay doing the work that you were doing when you were outside of the relationship. So for me, I go to therapy every 2 weeks. That cannot and will not change when I get into a relationship. It's an actual requirement for my relationships to be healthy. And if I stop going, my relationship is not going to be healthy. So I got to go because I've got to make sure that I'm checking in with myself and making sure that I'm cleansing myself of those things that I may be holding on to, right? The other thing is make sure that you are checking in with each other about asking questions like, hey, how are you pouring into yourself? What is the last thing you did that was for yourself? I see you taking care of me. What are you doing for yourself? And you can ask this of each other. And I think a lot of the things that we have to do is unlearn that your attention solely focuses on the other person in a relationship. Y'all are two individuals who have committed to doing a relationship together. That doesn't mean that you lose who you are. It just means that we're doing life together, but we still are individuals. And there are some things that are going to blend, and there are some things that are going to stay individual. It's like a Venn diagram. That little circle in the middle, that's ours. That's us. Mm-hmm. But these two on the side, that's empty spaces. Those are the ways that we still have to show up for ourselves. And honestly, the relationship is healthy when both people understand that you're not taking away from the relationship by working on yourself. If you're in a relationship with a person who feels like you taking time for yourself is you being selfish, then that's some work to do.
So follow-up question to that. Does that, and this may be going a little too deep into the weeds, is that related to, and I learned this recently, so I'm curious about it. Is that related to things like attachment styles or degrees of narcissism or things like that? Or is it something?
Well, this is the question that we have, right? One of the questions that y'all asked me was, how do people's traumas show up in relationships or some of the things around decision-making? Yeah. When we have experienced trauma, a lot of the things that we're doing is creating safety for ourselves so that we never experience that trauma again, right? So a lot of the things that we're doing is call me when you get to where you're going, because that's going to soothe my fear that may be rooted in me being scared in the past, or you can't have friends of the opposite sex, or you can't go here without me, or we're not doing that in this relationship. A lot of that is so that we can have some type of grounding, control, power. So a lot of the things that we're seeing as narcissism or calling narcissistic traits are definitely issues that people have that may be a result of trauma, or ways that they've learned that they can feel safe in these situations, right? A protector of vulnerability, so to speak. So a lot of people create rules and things in their relationship that keep them safe. So you will see that, and you will see people say things like, oh, you can't do that. I don't like when you do that. And we need to dive deeper into, why can't I do that? Why are you saying that that's not something that I can do? Because it may be an issue of safety. So a lot of people too have attachment issues. So your attachment may be rooted in insecurity. So if you have an insecure attachment style or an anxious avoidant attachment style, then you may do things that are a result of how your earlier caregiver or childhood attachments were that you're trying to avoid or trying to not recreate. So you may find yourself clinging to somebody. You may find yourself becoming too needy or needing to be around them all the time, codependent, people pleasing. A lot of these things end up coming out because we're trying to navigate those unresolved issues that are there.
Okay. So So I guess that answers the question as far as how trauma affects standards in the decision-making process, right? And I'm glad you mentioned that. I have a follow-up question to that, because you mentioned that, you know, we set boundaries, right? We set, it's a fear of not feeling safe, right? Mm-hmm. So maybe not a follow-up question, but maybe a kind of a, I'm sitting on your couch type of question. Like, okay, so how do you navigate to compromise on those, boundaries, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. To say, okay, you know, you need to text me, you know, like you said, text me when you get somewhere, right? So where's the compromise to say, okay, you know, I'll do that, but, you know, I need to feel this, or, mm-hmm. you know, I don't feel comfortable doing that, you know? So in your opinion, where does that compromise come in?
So it's not the same for everybody. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to add to that. And where does the difference lie between like a healthy boundary and And you know, something like a trauma manifesting itself. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
like a rule.
Yeah.
This is the rule. This is the way it's got to
be. Yeah,
exactly.
Good
so,
follow.
so it's not going to be the same for everybody. So I just want to put that disclaimer out. But it really is a matter of, are we, at what point does this now make me feel like I'm walking on eggshells? Or at what point do I now feel like this is causing me impairment in my functioning? I'm not comfortable, right? So if the compromise creates discomfort and it's significant discomfort, we can scale back and figure out what that looks like. So if you're telling me, text me, let me know you're okay. And you're like, okay, I ain't got a problem with that. But if you're telling me I'm pulling up to where you are because you didn't text me, then I'm like, whoa, there's dysregulation. Now there's overstepping now my boundaries. And now we got a whole argument that has happened because you didn't let me know where I was. And I lack the regulation skills to control my emotions around me going to worst case scenario. So what does this middle path look like? If this is happening, what is really going on here? I'm scared that something's going to happen to you because something happened to blah, blah, blah. Or my mind goes to worst case scenario. So I need you to always be checking in. Well, I can't always check in because it's rude for me to be at the table texting all the time. And it's inconvenient for me to leave work and be on my phone or leave out of a meeting. Like, all these things are now causing problems in other areas of my life. So how do we get you to a place where you can regulate yourself around your own fears? And how can we get to a place where that is comfortable for both of us? That's the conversation. What feels comfortable for both of us? I'll text you. Maybe I don't have to call you. Or let me check in with you, you know, on my break. I don't have to call you every time I'm in and out of a meeting every hour on the hour. Because then that starts to feel like control, right? So the couple gets to say, hey, this is good for us. And we both feel like we have freedom here. In individuality here, and this is still a place of comfort. We haven't entered into the red zone. When y'all start entering into a red zone and there's arguments and people feel like they are now being controlled, we need to go back to the drawing board and figure out what's the middle path, because that's not working. And so I think that's the work that we have to do. And if it's a rule, then boundaries are flexible. One of the things that people need to remember is there's room for boundaries to be flexible depending on the situation and the need. Rules don't have flexibility. So when it becomes a matter of it's going to be this way, or there are going to be severe repercussions or consequences, that's a rule. Boundaries are, okay, what's needed in this moment and what do I need to be effective? What do you need? So I may say, hey, don't call me after 9 o'clock. That's a boundary. But hey, you can call me after 9 if it's an emergency. That's a flexibility, right? Okay. Call me, text me, let me, you know, if something's, if we're on an emergency realm. But rules are, if you call me after 9 o'clock, X is going to happen, and X is going to happen no matter what. So you have to navigate that in a way to understand if there's flexibility here, what's really happening here, is there something here that we're not saying? Because a lot of times people aren't saying what the issue is, and we got to get to a place where, like, are you making me responsible for your fear? Are you making me responsible for your safety? Are you making me responsible for your manhood, masculinity, you needing to feel a certain way? And if you're making another person responsible for that, that's also another sign that we need to have a discussion about something.
Okay, so I guess my follow-up question, because we've kind of went into two questions in a matter of 5 minutes. My follow-up question to that is, like, I think, like you said, people correlate boundaries with rules. Right. So I guess my question is that, where's, I think what's missing is that, where's it come a point in time where it takes time for your partner to feel safe without feeling like you have to attach what I call your whole identity to make sure this person feels safe. Mm-hmm. Right. So, and you've talked about it a couple minutes before, but I really want to hone in on the thing where we spoke about it, where, and I know I did it, right? And I'm glad Jay asked the question about attachment style, because I attached my whole identity at one point to relationships. Mm-hmm. When I say identity, meaning I had to attach who I am, what I'm about, and what I'm willing to do for this person to make sure this person is happy and safe. and it's no issues, none. And she understands that I'm all about her, all in, invested 100%. And I feel like a lot of our brothers out there do that through attraction, through trying to impress a woman based off of these things I just mentioned, right? So my question is that what you just said is very true, but I feel like it's more difficult than, and I do think it needs more conversations.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So as a man and as a woman, right? If there's a boundary that's set because that person feels unsafe about that certain situation, what's a good starting point for a person to say, hey, I said this and made this point because I felt this way previously. This is what's happened to me. It's a trauma. It's been an issue. This is why my last relationship, any time. So can you kind of give advice on, I'm sorry to be, because I feel very passionate about it. You know what I mean? What's the starting point, right? How to start that conversation, how to build that communication, because that conversation can build to a lot of things: trust, security, safety, curiosity. Oh, this is why he said it. This is why he feels that way. This is why she feels that way. Can you kind of speak on that for our listeners out there, like who can't get to the point of starting that conversation?
Because that's a very vulnerable conversation to have, right? And in order to have that conversation, the space has got to feel safe enough for you to be vulnerable. So these are things that we've got to establish early in the relationship. What kind of conversations can we have, and is it safe to have those conversations? It's not a safe environment when you're telling somebody something and they ask you why, and you say, because I said so, don't ask me anything else. You've already established that this is not a safe space for me to ask why and for me to give you feedback. So the start of those conversations would be at the point of feedback, right? So if somebody says something like, hey, you told me to text you, but I didn't, but we're arguing, what happened? Like, why do you want me? Because if I come from a family where I was completely autonomous, nobody checked in on me, now I got in a relationship with you and now I got to check in, I'm like, why you want me to check in with you? You're like, well, if you don't want to check in with me, you're not the one for me. You basically just shut it down.
Okay.
So now I can't ask you any questions, right?
Okay.
Vice versa too. Like if you were telling a woman, hey, can you check in with me? And she's like, I'm not checking in with him, girl. He's not the one. Like, let me go, because this, he want me to check in with him. Like, this is not about to happen. So if you're not establishing space for people to be able to explain themselves, then it's not a safe environment for vulnerability. And vulnerability is required to have these kinds of conversations. So the starting point would be really in earlier relationships. If y'all have already been together for a while, then you want to start establishing, hey, I know we've been doing things this way, but I would love for us to do some check-ins. Okay. Quarterly check-ins, your job checks in quarterly, your daycare, school gives progress reports. Let us establish something like that for our relationship, where we check in with each other to see, maybe this was working for us for a while, but it's not working anymore. What are those things?
Okay.
So that can be, you know, you can have date night every week or whatever. Yeah, y'all get cute and dressed up, but when are we literally checking in with each other to see if things are still working here? Before they get together. So let us establish once a quarter, we're going to check in with each other. We're going to just kind of go back to the drawing board. We're going to do a retreat. Y'all, you told me y'all did a podcast retreat, right? Why are we not doing this in our relationships? Hey, and then so that's the opener of, you know, that last argument we had where you got mad at me because I didn't text you right away, or I went home and fell asleep. That didn't really make me feel good. Okay, now we can start this conversation about, now where's the middle path? So what do you want me to do? Should I text you? Do you want me to do this? Or should I do this? Or just kind of back up a little bit. Let me, if I'm asleep, then I'm asleep. I promise you I'm not doing anything. So how do we establish trust in our relationship going forward? Because honestly, that's the breakdown. The issue is not that you didn't text me, is that I'm scared and I'm fearing that something is happening, or I lack trust. So let's get to the root of this stuff, right? And then people, the one thing that I have to say as a therapist, a lot of people think that you have to be in therapy ongoing every week, every 2 weeks. Honestly, if you find a therapist that you can check in with once a quarter when y'all are doing y'all retreats, that's also okay.
Okay.
That's also okay. So find a third party maybe that you can have these conversations with and y'all can tease some things out. A neutral party that can help y'all make sense of some things, because it's definitely needed.
I have a follow-up question towards that, right? You mentioned that you said that the check-in piece, right? Mm-hmm. Like you mentioned, if I don't respond to your text or if I don't text you, I'm asleep or anything like that, right? I guess my follow-up question is the response to where, hey, I text you, you didn't respond. I know sometimes that can go back to the attachment style as far as like his response, knowing I didn't respond to his text and he's responding saying, and this is just an example, he cares, she cares. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? The caring about my whereabouts. Mm-hmm. Is that normal? Right? Is that, in my opinion, I feel like it's a little bit of a sense of normalcy. It shows a sense of caring and endearment. Is that, do you find that a little normal or a little alarming?
No, it's normal. We want to know that people are okay. When we care about people, we want to know. The way that we care about people just may show up differently. And just because your attachment style is not 100% secure, also does not mean that something is wrong with you. Or that you're showing up in your relationships is bad, right? Okay. One of my attachment styles is because of my attachment style, I'm a people pleaser, right? It has worked great for me, right? Because I get along with people really well and I build rapport with people really quickly, right? So it's not that something is bad, it's that, is it working for what is happening now? So I care about you. Is the way that you're caring about them working for them? That's it. Because I care about you and I may want to be around you, but that may be a little bit too much for you. So how do we find the middle path then of show me that you care about me, but also I can deal with a little less of this and a little more of this, right? So it's all about conversation and continuing to kind of like save space for y'all to negotiate what that's going to look like, right? Even when people become parents, who y'all were without children is going to be completely different who y'all are with children. So you cared for me this way prior to the children coming, that's going to look very different. Who I am is going to be very different. So how do we show up? So no, it's not, we're not going to pathologize caring for people. It's how we go about doing it. And if people are telling us it's a problem, if we keep doing it, then that's alarming.
Okay. Okay. I'm glad you said that. Go ahead, Jay. You had a follow-up question.
So I've seen this. And I know you said you don't want to pathologize how people are showing up in relationships, but I've heard this from friends, from coworkers, and from an outsider's perspective, I've found it concerning. But I would like your opinion on it. So I've multiple men and women in my in circles I find myself in have said, "Oh, if we agree that you're going to check in at a certain time or you're going to call me at a certain time and I don't hear from you, then I'm pulling up." And it's just like, how did we go from I missed a call to you're showing up at the crib? Like, that's not necessarily the, in my opinion, the healthiest way to show up. So how would you, like, where does that come from? Because I've always found it curious, and this might be an aside, but like it just confuses me that it's like, oh, you didn't show up for the past, 30 minutes, therefore the APB is out, I'm calling the police, like all of this sort of stuff. Like,
I think that's a shot at me.
No, it's not you.
I'm joking.
Co-workers, it's friends. It's like, it's a bunch of folks who I've heard this from, and I'm just like, that don't seem like you should be doing this. Like, are you okay?
Yeah. That's the rule that I was talking about, right? Like severe consequences. That went from I care about you to now that's a threat, right? Mm-hmm. It's not like a threat in terms of I'm a be physically aggressive with you. But now there's a consequence that doesn't match the action. Right? Okay. So why do you need to pull up if I didn't answer in 30 minutes? So my question as a therapist would be, how does that serve you and what's going on here? Right? So that serves me because I was worried. Okay. So we need to help you get some skills to regulate yourself. Because what happened is you immediately went to worst case scenario. So you told yourself something about why they didn't answer the phone that led you to then act on the urge or act on the feeling. And to resolve that feeling, you need to do something, and that doing something is the pulling up. So we got a bunch of issues before we got to the pulling up. We got a bunch of issues around trust. We got a bunch of issues around emotion regulation. And we got a bunch of issues around kind of like, why do you go to worst case scenario, which is probably rooted in trauma or some issues that have happened in the past where you just feel like, well, I'm gonna come see for myself because I don't trust that you're telling me the truth. I think something bad has happened. All of that's anxiety. Anxiety, worry, fear. So now we moved into territory that is far beyond what the situation called for. So now simply I was in a dead zone. The restaurant didn't have Wi-Fi or didn't have a connection. Now you outside, man, we got some other issues.
Yeah.
So let's just figure out how that's serving you first. And then if there's any issue we can do to help rectify, because that's a little concerning.
Wow. Wow. Go ahead, Jay.
I was curious, and I didn't want to take this too far off topic, but like it's something I've heard, and I've just been like, I'll just call you back at another time. But you know, I've heard multiple people just be like, oh, we rolling. I'm coming to every location where you've been in the past. And it's just like,
let me say
sir this. Or bam.
Let me say this. If you're in a relationship where somebody has been unfaithful and has engaged in infidelity, then you now have created an environment where somebody doesn't trust you. So most times when I've heard people say they're going to pull up, that's because something has happened that has planted fear and doubt in that person's mind about your whereabouts and your ability to tell them the truth and them to believe you. So sometimes people are pulling up because they've caught you before and they think you're doing the same thing again. So, so that happens for folks.
Do you feel like in those?
Go ahead.
I was gonna say, do you feel like in those situations, there's no room for reassurance? There's no room for, to a point where it can never, like you said, never get back to the yellow or green zone.
It can, but there's a lot of deep work that has to happen in order to recover from infidelity. There's a lot of accountability that people are going to have to do. And at the beginning, you honestly, if you were the person who engaged in the infidelity, you're going to have to do a lot of work to gain that person's trust again. And you're going to have to sit in the hot seat a lot. So you can find that somebody asks you things like, you're like, we talked about that before. Okay, we can talk about it again, because just as much as you reassured me 5 minutes ago, it's fleeting and I need it again. And so at the beginning, you're going to have to do a lot of work around reassuring. And as time goes on, that fades typically for people. But sometimes the issue is that people don't like to sit in the hot seat, and they'll say things like, we already talked about that. Don't ask me about that again. Or I'm not continuing to talk about this. We already went over that. And it's because they can't stand the vulnerability and it's too much. But honestly, if you created that, it's up to you to fix that. And now here's the other part that the other person now has to do. If this is a situation that you're continuing to keep yourself in, you've got to understand that people have to be able to move past it and redeem themselves. But if you are a person who's been so hurt in the past that now you'll never trust them again, don't make them continue to explain to you for life that they've done wrong, and you never even have it in you to forgive them in the first place, or let them redeem themselves, let's say. So if you know that that's something you can't get over, tell the truth about that rather than holding on to that now 10 years down the line and you still bringing it up, still pulling up. Now y'all got these harsh rules that exist between y'all because you have not done your work. So just as much as the person who created the issue has to do, the person who experienced it on the other end has so much deep work to do too. So recovering from infidelity in a relationship, it's a trauma that has to be worked through. That takes some time, and that takes a lot of vulnerability and accountability.
I will say the infidelity part, you know, I've never, you know, I don't want to correlate my experience with that, but I've dealt with past relationships where that has happened.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I think for me, and I think this is kind of new territory for us, I think I blamed my And I wonder if some, and I would love to hear feedback from you and our audience. I blame my attachment style to the reason why infidelity was an issue in my past relationship, right? And I feel, and I correlate that to people not being able, being able to be who they are in going newer relationships because they feel that same attachment style will get the result of infidelity. So I guess my follow-up question is that how do you, that work, right? That you spoke about a little earlier. And I'm very interested to know, like, that work you have to put in, because I know I took some reflection for myself. It wasn't a long reflection, right? To where I felt like I had to change my attachment style because I felt my attachment style to that relationship was the reason it resulted in the way it did, right? Mm-hmm. So what do you say to those people who feel like they have to, they've lost identity, they've lost who they are, they sense a sense of attachment style to their identity, which was attached to that relationship. How do you kind of work through that? I guess I'm sitting on your couch again. how do people work through that, right? Can you kind of give some kind of key? I mean, it doesn't have to be like a list, but can you kind of give some examples of like, man, what do you do? What do you do to, you're basically going into a relationship trying to figure out who you are, how to be, and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's the same thing that I said earlier. Like if you're going to be in the relationship and stay in it, you've got to figure out, who am I? Why did I do the thing that I did? It's not enough to say I did that because that's my attachment style.
Okay. Yes, okay.
Yes, and. I did that. And so underneath the attachment style is a whole bunch of reasons why something is happening, right? So if I'm saying, well, the reason that I cheated or the reason that I talked to them or was flirting with them was because that's my attachment style. I'm just a people pleaser. That's not enough. Mm-hmm. Underneath that is, well, sometimes in order for me to feel accepted, I feel like I have to do this. Or when I'm feeling like people don't like me, it causes me to feel very uneasy. Or I struggle with not having people like me. Or I'm struggling with my self-esteem now. And the way that I build up my self-esteem or feel good about myself is seeing if other people like me. Or it really gives me a boost when I find that other people like me. And here's a deeper one. Because my younger self was so rejected by a particular type of person, when that person approached me this time, it fed that part of me that was insecure and rejected when I was little.
Okay.
That's the deeper point. Part that many of us are dealing with, right? It's not enough to just, that's my attachment style. But the issue, the reason we even developed that attachment style in the first place has to do with that particular issue that I just stated. I never felt wanted. I never felt chosen. So now I do these things to get that for myself. And when this opportunity presented itself to me, I took it because my younger self just felt like I needed to be needed. I needed to be wanted. I wasn't feeling good at that time. And they were showing me attention. And this is hard for people to say, but I never got that attention from that kind of person. That person never paid attention to me. Or when I looked like this, they never gave me the time of day. So now that they're seeing me, it made me feel good to be chosen. These are the conversations and truths we got to tell to ourselves. And that's how you get back to finding your individuality. Because if I can tell that truth, I can help myself the next time it happens, right? So what I know about myself is I'm a person who thrives on being chosen. How do I make that something that happens in my relationship? How do I manage the insecurity I feel when I'm not chosen? That's the individual work.
Oh man, amazing, amazing, amazing point. So
I got a follow-up question, and this might be a quick answer, but when you do that internal work, do attachment styles change, or is it sort of this is your attachment style and it's not gonna switch up?
They shift. So I think of most things in our lives exist on a spectrum. Most people think that they're either quadrant, black and white. No, they exist on a continuum. So you can move in and out of attachment styles. So you have your primary one, but you will also see that some things are reminiscent of others. And as you heal, those things become, they're there, but they become less apparent. So you may never get to 100% secure attachment, right? But you can have some flavors of secure attachment, also with some flavors of what you used to have, and also some flavors of some other things. So yeah, you can have some sprinkling of some other things here and there. It's very much like a personality disorder too. You may never change the core of who you are, but some stuff may be sprinkled here and there, and you'll float between different ones sometimes.
I will say I will have a follow up as far as my experience that actually happened to me. Mm-hmm. I felt like even to this day, I feel like my attachment style has kind of shifted. Mm-hmm. And in the beginning, I felt really hurtful about it and really bad about it, because I was like, I'm not giving her 1,000 percent of my attention or me. And it kind of made me a little depressed. Mm-hmm. Right. Because I felt like I wasn't being who I thought I should be. Right. But in reality, it was more about, hey, I can take this time to focus on who I should be or who I am. And I feel like that's the most difficult thing to transition from, to feel like you're, that's why we say, you know, you should really be with somebody you need, because that person can understand, that give you the space and the time to work on you while you're in a relationship. And I'm thankful I got that. And that's just kind of my experience, because I felt like I struggled with that. I struggled with the feeling and losing my identity, feeling like I had to give 1,000% to someone and forget about what I needed. But being married and understanding and understanding that space that I needed to work on myself, I felt like I've made a complete 180, you know, for myself, and realizing who I am as a man and who I want to be and continue to be. So I appreciate you saying that, because I feel like I just learned a lot. It brought a light bulb to me. Jay, we'll kind of go into the last question about the, and I'll edit this part out, some ways mental health industry can evolve, because I feel like she's answered all all the, you know, questions. So. But go ahead.
All right. You touched on it a little bit in terms of, you know, overly pathologizing people or overly diagnosing people and everything like that. But one question I had, and this is a question I have for a lot of mental health experts, is what are some ways that you think the mental health industry needs to evolve or needs to grow?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've come a long way. We have such a long way to go. But I think that we need to do a better job of making it okay or accessible for therapists to practice in multiple states. We're, like I said, I'm a part of the PsyPAC, which allows psychologists to join this pack where we can practice in 30 other states. But I think we need to do that on a more broad level. And we need states to agree so that people can get the help that they need. And it's not happening quick enough. The process is not affordable to everybody. So I think we need to do a better job of making therapists available just across state lines. That could solve so many issues, period. We need to do another job. We need to do a better job of how much therapists make. We don't have an issue with, so I work with some clients who may be going through some litigation issues, and they're telling me things like, if I text my attorney, they charge me 10 cents per text message. But people don't think therapists should make that kind of money. And so it's the amount of income that we are allowed to make, or the pay, needs to drastically change. Nobody has an issue paying psychiatrists per 15 minutes. Medical doctors are paid per 15 minutes, and psychologists are paid by the hour. Therapists are paid by the hour. There's a huge issue with that. And insurance companies are largely responsible too, because they are not paying therapists wages that are commensurate with their experience, training, or the amount of work that we do. So we need to evolve in that way. I think that we need to evolve in terms of addressing the issue that causes people to show up with mental health issues in the first place. A large part of the way the mental health field has done things, is made it seem like it's the individual's fault that they are experiencing the things that they are experiencing, when literally many of us are depressed because of systemic issues. Work, job, poverty. A lot of us are carrying poverty into relationships, or money issues, scarcity mindset into relationships. And a lot of that is because many of us didn't have a lot growing up. Those issues aren't being addressed. A lot of us are suffering with depression, mental health issues because of racism. So there's a lot of things that the mental health field is not taking responsibility for or looking at, that I think could really change the way that we do therapy and the way that we show up with folks in this world. The other issue is just on an individual level. this is for therapists to do. I think therapists have got to do a better job of making themselves available via the social media channels that we have. Because if not, then you have regular, and nothing's wrong with this, but you have so much misinformation. People making up names about issues that don't really exist. So people telling people they have love addictions, or all these terms that people are coming up with, because we are so we are so conditioned and taught to operate behind a chair or an office that we don't want to be seen to the general public. So we can't put out information that people could actually use to educate themselves. But we have all this other general information running around that people just have access to. That's why everybody has been labeled as narcissistic when they're not. Because these terms are just floating around. So I think we need to do a better job of being available to the general public to help educate more about what mental health really is and what some of these terms really mean.
Okay. Very, very, very good point.
You mentioned narcissism. What is a term that you wish would just exit the therapy conversation altogether?
Yeah, narcissism. Every ex is not a narcissist. Every ex, because they didn't like you or they were mean to you, does not make you a narcissist. Like, that's probably a pet peeve of mine, is everybody calling their ex a narcissist. And I'm like, no. Another word, and I know I'm probably hugely responsible for this, but I really wish everybody would stop labeling everything as a trauma, because everything is also not a trauma. I mean, let me say, I believe people get to define trauma in ways that they understand. I don't get to define that for people, but I do believe that because the word floats around, everybody uses it in ways that actually may not depict a trauma, but actually may just be some way that they explain that something really bad happened to them. So I think that it's these terms just floating loosely that kind of yeah, we're overdoing it a bit, but.
So to sort of undo some of the damage, so to speak, how would you define a trauma?
Something that significantly alters the way that you show up in the world. And I use significantly on purpose. So if it restructures the way you think about the world, operate in the world, the way your brain is wired, that's a trauma, right? So, but if something like, so if I almost, for example, just for lightheartedness, if a dog comes running out behind me and I'm like, oh my God, that scared me, but I can go on about my day and then the next day is fine and the next month is fine, that wasn't a trauma. I was scared, right? But some people are like, oh, you broke up with me, that was traumatizing. So in what ways has it significantly altered your world? If it now has had you now hypervigilant, if it now has you unable to sleep, your appetite is changed, okay, so we got some significant impairments, right? But if it's just kind of like, well, I don't like him and I just have negative views about him or her, then is that really a trauma? And so before, when people come into me, you can define trauma in whatever ways you want to, but we really do work around, how does it serve you to name it that? Why are we naming it that? What else may have happened? But that's not a battle, honestly, that I want to fight. Like if that's a trauma and you see it, go ahead. You know, it's just kind of just like a thing that irks me almost, but I'm not going to fight that battle if I don't have to.
So we're going to go right into our wrap it up session. Pretty much, you know, we give our guests 3 to 5 minutes to let everybody know who they are, giving gems. So Dr. Ebony, you've got the floor, man.
Well, thank y'all. This has been such a good conversation. So since we're on the topic of relationships, one of the things that I would leave people with is to understand that relationships have the opportunity to grow. Most of us get into relationships with the idea that, hey, we're going to grow together, but we really don't understand what we're saying. So one thing that I love to tell people is make sure that your relationships have room to be different at each developmental phase. For instance, when your child or when a child is a newborn, you don't still talk to them the same ways that you did when they are now a 7-year-old. You don't still talk to the 7-year-old the same way that they are now 16. The same methods by which you parented them are not the same. The same way by which you engage with them are not the same. So treat your relationship just like that. When your relationship is 2 years old, you did things differently. But now that your relationship is 16, you've got to treat a 16-year-old very different than you did a 2-year-old. But many of us are still holding a 16-year-old relationship by the same standards that we are a 2-year relationship, where you don't act the same. Well, no, I don't, because I'm now 16 years older than I was, right? Or 14 years older than I was, right? So we've got to begin to engage from that place. If the relationship is now 20, how do we deal with a 20-year-old? What does this 20-year-old now need that the 6-year-old person did not need? And so if you take a developmental approach to your relationship and understand that at different points it's going to need different things, you are probably going to be better off and have a more sustainable and healthy interaction in that relationship than expecting it never to change and things to always stay the same and continuing to hold people to the same standards of who they were earlier in the relationship. So that's something that I always like to leave people with. The other thing is, don't forget about you. Don't forget about you in any instance. Don't forget about you are working on your relationship with food or your body, your weight. Don't forget about what feels authentic to you. It's so easy to hear what other people say and to internalize that, but get back to trusting and learning how to trust your own voice, learning how to be the person that you are and understanding what that looks like in all of these contexts, because it's going to make a difference and it helps you not to lose yourself. So those are my tidbits. You can find me online, social media at Dr. Ebony Online. And then my website is drebony.com. And if you want to check out the therapy cards, you can go to mytherapycards.shop.
I am personally going to be checking out those therapy cards. Very interested. I feel like, you know, it's my transition into reading a lot of different things. Really appreciate it, Dr. Ebony, for taking the time out with us today. Make sure you guys follow her at Dr. Ebony Online. Follow her content, very great content. Also, make sure you like, share, subscribe. This is going to be up in a little while here. Make sure, let us know what you guys think. Is she wrong about trauma? Have you felt that trauma? You know, do you agree with her thoughts on trauma, that it's, everything's not a trauma? I just learned that today, actually. I'm going to probably sit back and think about that.
I was today years old.
yeah. And I love her aspect on, you know, a 2-year relationship is not going to be the same thing as a 15-year relationship. I love that aspect. Love that notion. And talking about standards and decision making outside of the relationship versus inside a relationship. I love to hear you guys' thoughts and feedback. Make sure you guys follow us on YouTube at Let's Rock Podcast. Follow us on Instagram at the same handle. Really appreciate Dr. Ebony for taking the time out with us today and really having this great conversation. I'm Philosophical from the Let's Rock Podcast.
I'm Jay Echo.
And we out, y'all. Peace.
Take it easy.
Look, man, appreciate you guys having me. Shout out to y'all, man. And yeah, I'm happy to be here, man.
Thank you for having me. I'm honored to be here, man. You guys are doing amazing things.
Good, man. We're doing good. I see you guys looking great.
Well, I appreciate y'all for having me out, taking y'all time, and promoting positive black image.